originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is Trainer Talk, and it's all presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna and retired trainer Jude Feld, we are with you once again in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, and want to extend a very special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 219 XM Channel 206, and all of you tuning in worldwide on our website at horseracingradio.net, and many of you also listening to us on your smartphones and tablets. Welcome to the program. Happy to have you with us for what promises to be an amazing hour. JT, a lot of people are going to describe the story of tonight's guest as being a rags-to-riches type of story. I prefer to look at it a little bit differently and say that this is a story of unwavering perseverance and determination.
Well, yeah, it's a fantastic story, and our guest has had my admiration for a long, long time because he gets to call his own shots, and I don't think there's any finer way to be a horse trainer than to be in total control. And because he puts up his own money, a considerable amount of it, yep, and can do as he wishes, I think it's just a dream job, really.
Well, he was raised in El Cajon, California, which is roughly about 27 miles from Del Mar. He began training in 2005 and spent the next 3 years doing what he loves. Everything was pretty good. And then in 2007, he was forced to step away from training and would do so for nearly a decade before returning to the business in a big, big way. He officially saddled his first graded stakes winner in last year's Grade 1 Del Mar Futurity. Now, that's a horse you've probably heard of. His name is Bolt Doro. Yeah, he would go on to win the Grade 1 Front Runner Stakes at Santa Anita before finishing third in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, and now finds himself among the early favorites for this year's Kentucky Derby. And oh, by the way, Bolt Doro was purchased as a yearling for $650,000 at the 2016 Fasig Tipton Saratoga Select Sale. Please join us in welcoming tonight's guest. He is trainer Mick Ruiz to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Mick, welcome, my friend.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, appreciate you spending a little time with us here and really looking forward to hearing your story. As I began researching your story and your background, I got more and more enthralled by everything that you've gone through and been able to overcome. So I guess let's just start at the beginning. Take us back to where your love of horse racing began.
Well, when I was 18 years old, Agua Caliente Racetrack in Tijuana, Mexico was running. And, you know, I'm born and raised in San Diego, so they used to run on Saturday and Sunday. And my grandmother, who's 100% Irish, she would always go to the horse races and stuff like that. So when I turned 18 and I can go down there, I would go down there on the weekend, and I would say, man, if I could just get together $3,000 for one of these claimers down here, my life would be complete, you know? And that's where it all started down there, and, you know, we're still buying horses today.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It used to be so much fun to go to Caliente and hang out, and you'd see some of the trainers from Southern California. Laz Barrera was down there quite a bit, and being the turf club, eating good Mexican food and drinking some cervezas, and it was a big event the weekends there. Plus the Pick Six started there, so that was a draw for many people.
Yeah, it was called the 5-10, and it would be on TV at the end of the newscast. It would do the numbers that the horses would run, you know, and people that would do their 5-10 tickets, and they would watch the news with Ernie Myers and see if they won some money. That goes way back.
Yeah, yeah, that was great. People didn't realize too that the ladies that worked at Caliente, they figured out those tickets by hand. I don't know if you ever saw them do that, but they had to figure out that there wasn't a computer system to do it. So they put all the horses from the first leg in a slot by post position, and then they'd narrow them down as the day went on. It was pretty intriguing.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Agua Caliente, and that was when Mick Ruiz was 18 years old, 1979. He fell in love with the sport immediately, as you just heard him say. He figured if he could find a way to get $3,000 to claim one of the horses, his life would be complete. Mick, how do you look at it now, looking back on those days? You say it's just incredible. I mean, how do you view it now?
Well, you know, we're so fortunate, you know, to have the pedigrees and the horses that we got now. But you know, if you're going to train in Southern California and you have to, you know, train against all the Hall of Fame trainers here, if you don't have the stock, you know, you can get very, very fortunate. Like we got Boldoro last year, we had Union Strike, grade one winner, you know, and we only bought 13 one year, 14 the next year. So that's all that we bought. But you know, we tried to step it up to different levels, and it seemed like the most expensive horse we bought, not last year, the year before, was Union Strike at the sale. She was 365. She was a grade one winner. So the most expensive horse we bought the next year was Boldoro, and he was 630,000. So, you know, we got lucky on the two most expensive ones. And then, you know, you try to get some of the less expensive ones. You check out the confirmation, the pedigree. You know, you get them scoped and x-rayed, and you hope for the best. But, you know, there's probably a reason why you have to really step up to the plate when you have a specimen like Bolt, what he looked like when he was a yearling.
So many people will tell the story that you just told about going to the racetrack for the first time and becoming hooked on the sport immediately. It happened for me as well, but mine was 10 years after you, 1989 at Saratoga, and it was the Traverse Stakes when Easy Goer won that year, and I knew that this was something I had to be part of. What is it about the sport of thoroughbred racing that just gets in your blood? What do you think it is, Mick?
Well, it's, you know, all my kids were athletes. They were wrestlers, the boys. And you could, when you're training a human being, they can talk back to you. You can know, you can get in their head to help them out, give them more confidence. And in the thoroughbreds, I try to train like that. And the thrill is just, you know, you see them coming in every day when you go to the barn. You see them growing up. You see them when they get their owies. You back off on them. You don't really know what's in that heart and what's in that engine until they start getting into competition. And that's really the exciting part, because, you know, once you get in the gate and it's a horse race, anybody can win, you know. So to be able to go every day and train and see how they are that morning, see how they are that week, see how they're coming up to a race is really exciting. And to me, that's the most satisfying part now, to you know, because there's a lot of rail birds out there that you know, will, you know, I don't know, criticizes the word, but you know, why Bolt should be in another barn, you know, with experience, and man, he would win the Triple Crown already before running him if he was in this barn or that barn. So that's a real cool fire for all of our little barn that we got. You know, I have my daughter Shelby, she owns a trainer's license. She's in the barn. Jose de Lima, he has a trainer's license. He works underneath me also. And Sal Marquez has a trainer's license. So three people directly underneath me in my barn with only 34 horses own trainer's license. So all the horses are well taken care of. You know, we try to do the right thing for them. But the thrill is, boy, when you see that horse, it could be a 12,000 claimer, it could be an 8,000 claimer, but when you cross that finish line, there's just nothing like it.
And the beauty of what you do is you're in charge, so you're immune to the comments. I mean, they may hurt your feelings or give you that fire to do the best you can, which you probably already have, but you can't get fired. You're the one trainer that can't get fired. And so you can do whatever you want, you know?
The worst that can happen to me is Wendy says, you're on the couch tonight, But she'll forgive me in the morning. So, yeah, I'm not getting fired from anybody.
Mick Ruiz, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mick, you really didn't come from a racing family like a lot of trainers do, did you?
No, not at all. I wouldn't say we were poverty poor, but we were poor. And, I never knew what racing was.
Yeah, I read somewhere that you said that typically you would get a couple pairs of shoes a year, and then toward the end you had to gray tape them to keep them up and keep those same shoes going. Is that true?
Yeah, my dad was a construction worker. He worked hard. I had three siblings, and towards the end of the year then, I loved playing kickball as a kid. You'd wear those shoes out, so he got free duct tape from the construction. I was always duct taping those things up to last till the next pair come.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, pretty cool part of the story. And then you mentioned your boys being wrestlers. You wrestled too, didn't you?
Yeah, I wrestled for El Capitan High School. It's in San Diego County. And then actually went to the Junior Pan Am Games in Mexico City. And, I ended up winning a gold medal down there. But my boys, I would say, were a lot better wrestlers than me. They started really young. I started when I was a freshman in high school, and I really loved basketball. It's kind of like the Drayden Van Dyke, how he loved basketball, but a little short. And I went out for the team and was trying out for the team of basketball, and, I was thinking I was okay, but I was 85 pounds and about 5'4", and the wrestling coach came in and said, "Hey, we're looking for a 95-pounder. Why don't you come try out for the wrestling team?" And I'm shooting the basketball. I'm like, "Yeah, all right. I want to play basketball." Until the basketball coach says, "I think you ought to try out for the wrestling team." I was smart enough to figure where I needed to go.
That's great.
Tell me about winning the gold medal. That had to be a tremendous experience at that point in your life.
Yeah, it was really fun, since I didn't even start out until I was a freshman. But I'm a pretty driven person. I want to be the best whatever I do, and I drive myself to achieve that. And, I was just the desire, and that's the one thing why I wanted all my kids to wrestle, because it's one of those sports where you don't get all the showboating of a basketball player, a football player, they get the headlines, and you can blame it on the guy that, it can be an interception or something. And but wrestling, it's a sport where it teaches you discipline, really self-respect for the other wrestler or the other person. And the harder you work at that, the better you could be. And I just took that into my work ethic and, building my companies from nothing to, and I take that all back to wrestling, how hard you had to wrestle and what you knew that if you cheated or if you only wanted to do push-ups for, say, a couple hundred a night, but if you did 1,000 a night, how much you were ahead of them. When my boys would wrestle, they would tight waist these other little kids that were 7, 8 and literally make them cry because that's how much stronger they were.
Yeah, the conditioning is such a big factor. Do you find that mentality helps you as you train your horses?
Yes, it does. I'm learning every day, and I ask questions, to Mr. Drysdale, Mr. Mandela, Mr. Sheriffs. Steve Mayotte. I'm the guy that probably asks a million questions to a million trainers backside. I don't think there's a dumb question I ever ask. Some people might say, "Well, that guy doesn't even know what he's talking about." You might ask a million people their opinion, and you might use one or two of them. But I'm the guy in the backside asking questions. And it's worked for me.
What have some of those questions been like, Mick? What things have you wanted to know?
Well, I second-guessed myself in going into the Breeders' Cup. We had Boldoro, and I'm like, wow, I got this monster. I'm listening to everybody tell me that this horse can't lose. It can't lose, you know. They draw the 11 hole, and I'm like trying to be optimistic. Oh, it ain't going to matter. We're going to get out there. You know, Corey will get him out there or drop him in, and, you know, we'll still get it. We got the best horse. So going into the Breeders' Cup, I think, see, I always would work Bolt in a little bit of company just to keep his enthusiasm up. And I did the last three works without company going in the Breeders' Cup thinking, I just want to keep him sound. Let's do Bobby Frankel style. Let's do some slower works. We got the horse. Let's just keep airing them. And I think I lost a little bit of that competitiveness by not working in company. So that's kind of why this time around, you know, he's worked in company. If it had to be a little slower or, you know, have a horse go 10 in front of him that wasn't too good, but catch him at the end. I just wanted to give a little more focus on Bolt. And I kind of learned that by some told me, no, you don't need to do that. You can go slow. Others says, no, you need to drill the heck at him. Watch the way Bob trains. You know, so I've kind of came up with my own little way of the way I think I need to do. And I do take that back to training because my boys, we would go to national tournaments, and, you know, I would drill the heck out of them a couple weeks before the nationals and then turn it down a little bit a week before, you know. But the week of it, I didn't shut down the practice. You know, I had a couple hard days of practice, and then the last couple days before we go in there, you know, we would do light exercises to keep the lactose out of the blood there. So I know they can't talk to you, the horses, but being there every day, one thing I can say that I know every horse in my stall's name. I go see them three times a day. I love going there in the evening and the afternoon, you know, about 6 o'clock. They've already started eating around 4. And when they come to the front of the webbing and say hi or do something, those ones are good. And then I got some of them you'll say, wow, why is she moping in the corner of the stall here? You know, and then so you can watch them a little bit more in the morning and stuff. And so I really like that because, you know, I mean, I'm sure most of the trainers do that, but you just get a sense of how they feel the next morning. So if they're not having enough energy, you would say, well, yeah, they didn't that night before. Let's check out the feed. Let's see how they do. It's a lot more satisfying when you're totally hands-on. I don't have a big training center where the call of my assistant and how that is and finally get the horse in it after they've breezed it 6 times, you know? So we could start from the day when we bring them from the auction or the day we raise them on the farm to breaking them to having them. So it's really, I think, satisfying that way.
Yeah, the continuity can't be replaced, really, when you have them at your farm and they're being broken and then you get them in. And you know everything that's happened with that horse. There's no question of where the horse has been or what it's been doing. You've got that all at your fingertips. That's another reason why I admire what you do so much, because it's really the classic way of being able to train a horse and have total control. It's just it's phenomenal, really.
Well, and I also think that, you know, there's not one bit of this money that we're winning or we get for our stallion deal or when we breed them that we're going to live on. You know, I have my businesses I built from scratch, so I'm investing everything back that I have in horse racing into horse racing, that all my purses. And we just bought a farm in Lexington, 4 miles from Keeneland, Mr. House's old chestnut farm over there. So that's where the Bolt babies are going to be raised. And so I don't have the pressure, I think, to make the wrong decisions that, wow, you know, I could sell this horse and, you know, we need this to keep the stable going or we need to do that. I do think I have the advantage that way, which I see a lot of the trainers, and these are great, great trainers, I mean, every single day. And they have a lot of pressure on them. You know, they might not act like they do, but they don't win. They don't get clients. They don't get clients. They don't put food on their table.
Mick, who are the trainers that you would most like to emulate with your training style?
I would say Mr. Sheriffs, Mr. Drysdale. They're very patient with their horses. And if you notice, when the horses are going to run, they're usually going to do really, really good. They have a lot of foundation underneath them. And I think their clients send horses to them knowing that they're not saying, okay, we got to have a two-year-old champion, or first out, we got to win by 11. We win the futurity, and then where's the horse again? You know, there's different owners for different trainers. There's instant gratification, and then there's other ones that say, you know, let's do it the slower foundation way. And that's kind of the way I look up to those guys. And then I look at Bob. What a brilliant trainer Mr. Baffert is. Look at the way he trains them. He has a luxury to train them a little harder, but they're athletes. If they're going to make it, they're going to make it. But, you know, I see Bob. You would think that, wow, he's won the Triple Crown. He's had these Derby winners. You go by his barn, there's like 100 plaques, Horse of the Year, Champion, 2-year-old, this, that. I mean, everything he's did is incredible. But, man, I think the most thing I admire about Bob is seeing him stress every day, caring about it, what he's doing. You know, I mean, I, as a businessman and as a father and a granddad, you know, while we all have things in life that stress us out, Bob still is walking down that thing, stressed out, talking, doing it, you know, and you got to take that off. Everything he's doing, he cares that much. But I kind of would like to be between a Bob Baffert and a Mr. Drysdale and Mr. Sheriff's in between there. Not too hard on them, but not too soft on them, because, you know, I want to get to the races.
You know, Bob's had some really complimentary things to say about you over the past several months, Mick. And I know that that's a relationship that has grown in its own unique way, and there's a lot of respect on both sides. How would you describe your relationship with Bob Baffert?
I would, real competitive, you know, because I want to be like Bob, you know, I want to win the races that Bob does. And so I'm always watching, what's going on, but on a personal level, where Wendy and myself have got to, you know, spend a little time with him and talk to him. He's really a super nice human being, but competitive, yeah. Going to show you his cards, never going to happen. Ask him something that you might want to know, you're not going to get the answer that you want to hear. You get the one that Bob wants to hear, because he's in there to win. And I respect that, and I admire him. But, yeah, he's got a tough job. You know, when you got 100 horses that you've paid maybe $500,000 each for, and you have the top owners in the racing industry or in the world, there's a lot of pressure on you, you know? It's like, so, and he handles it, you know?
Yeah, he does handle it better than almost anybody I've ever seen. He's very contemplative about his horses. He's always thinking about, you know, what he can do with this one or that one, or where he's going to run them. And his mind is going 300,000 miles an hour all the time. And yet he still has time to laugh and joke and play around. And that's the beauty of his personality. But yeah, I can see that you know, when you operate at a high level like you do and you want to win those races, it's competitive, but I'm glad that you guys have hit it off and that you're friends.
Yes, yeah, very much so.
Mick, you know, you're only 4 Kentucky Derby victories behind Bob. And you're coming into this year with Bolt Doro, and at this point, looking like he could be a major player if all things being equal. He gets there on the first Saturday in May. Do you even think that far ahead and think about what it might be like to have your horse cross the finish line first beneath those twin spires?
You know, what I think about is, you know, we're going to go this race here Saturday, which is really important. Bolt's really training up to it. Then it's going to be the Santa Anita Derby. Then it's up to Bolt. I think Bolt's the best horse out there. I really do. He's phenomenal. Bob's really thinks Bolt's a beautiful horse. At the end of the day, it's my team's job to make sure Bolt's healthy. to make sure he gets to the starting gate, to get the best rider we can possibly get. Just after that, it doesn't matter if it's Bob Baffert, Mick Ruiz, or a guy that, you know, just barely started on the backside, has been around horses for a long time. It's up to the horse, you know. Sure, we're the coach and the manager, but at the end of the day, without Bolt, you know, I don't think I'd be talking to you guys right now.
Mick, I wonder if he would be the first Kentucky Derby winner to be broke in the state of Montana. When did you first know he was special?
You know, when Ike bought him at Saratoga Select, I don't know if too many people know the story. You know, I said I'd go to 500,000. That got up there pretty quick. The owner of Songbird, Mr. Porter, I think his name is, he was bidding on it on a Bolt also, and it ended up going at 25,000 increments with just him and us. Until we got to 500, then I told him, okay, we'll keep going, and we got up to 600. And, you know, I said, okay, 600, that's it. He went up to 625. And Ike says, boss, let me try something. And I say, well, what are you going to do? He goes, I got to hang up. I'm going to try for $5,000. So he hangs up the phone. Next thing I know, he's calling back, says we got it. I go, what? He goes, yeah, I bid $5,000. They got mad because it was 25 increments. They walked away for Bolt for $5,000, and we got him for 630.
So wow.
I'm like going, this could be a really cool story, or it could be, man, he sure did get lucky by getting mad and walking away. He just saved himself $630,000, right?
Yeah, goes both ways.
Then we got him to Montana, and he was running in his 10-acre, you know, pasture out there, full steam. That's when we knew we had something special. He just glided across. But then I was just always, when I was getting the videos from Ike, or if I was up there visiting the ranch, I'd be like, one gopher hole, and there's my $630,000 down the drain, you know? But we wanted him to be a horse. We wanted him to build muscle. We wanted him to not, we didn't have one horse shin buck out of the 13 we brought from Montana to the racetrack last year. So we let them be horses and see what they can do. He got down after first, Ike got on him and said, boss, I've been on a horse since I'm 12 years old. Never been on something that moves like this before. He is so smooth, and he's got different gears. So that was kind of fun, just from the ranch. After we broke him and told him that, we got him down to San Luis Rey, and Ron Glatt works for me. You know, he's a really, really great trainer, older guy. And he's, you know, I trust him with my babies there before they get to me at in Santa Anita. And Ron said, these are real special ones. The exercise rider's boss, this one's really special. We got him to Santa Anita, and that's when they said, he's got gears. You know, he's got gears that other horses don't have, and he's so smart, and he's kind, you know, almost kind where we say, we got to wake him up to go to the races now. So that's how the story is. We knew that, you know, he was special.
And, of course, purchased from our good friend Craig Banderoff and Denali Stud, and bred by our friends at Windstar. So a lot of great connections surrounding Bolt Doro as he continues to make his way down that road to the Kentucky Derby on the first Saturday in May. Mick Ruiz is our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We're going to step away for a short commercial break. When we come back, we'll probably talk a little more about Bolt Doro, but we'll also talk a little bit more about some of the things that Mick had to overcome to get to this point in his life. It's an amazing story. We'll tell you all about it next, right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale. Join us Florida Derby Week at the nation's premier destination for selected two-year-olds in training. From Kentucky Derby winner Nyquist to recent stars like Dreamtree, More Spirit, Audible, and Mopetism, Gulfstream grads are hotter than ever. This year's sale boasts quality from top to bottom and an under-tax show held over Gulfstream's dirt racetrack. Selected sales, superior results. The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, March 28th. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
They come into the top of the lane. Soul Street is giving way at the rail. Runaway now up to get the lead. Zatter, Bolt Doro's running up. Big one on the outside. We come down to these three. Homeward Bound now. Runaway's got to find more. He can. Zatter can, and so can Bolt Doro. So we're coming down to two now. Coming to the 16th pole. And it's Zatter and Bolt Doro. Bolt Doro's doing the better of the two. Bolt Doro strikes the front. And Bolt Doro's going to take the Del Mar Futurity. Bolt Doro and Corey Nakatani have beaten Zatter. Behind that Runaway, Dia DePago was in behind them. Then came Soul Street, Tatters to Riches, Gracida, Master Ruler, and Fleetwood was last.
Trevor Denman with the call of the Del Mar Futurity last year. That was the first Grade 1 victory in the career of trainer Mick Ruiz. Also the first Grade 1 victory, the first of two consecutive Grade 1s for Bolt Doro, who was so impressive and came back and finished third in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile last year. And returning this weekend at Santa Anita, you'll be able to catch him in the San Felipe as he makes his three-year-old debut. A showdown with McKenzie should be a good one. And we'll try to bring it your way on the Horse Racing Radio Network as part of our coverage this Saturday, if everything works out timing-wise. So keep an eye on our website, horseracingradio.net, for more information on that. And of course, if you missed any portion of this show, you can head over to our website and check out the podcast. It's all there for you to listen to at your leisure, horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, back with you in our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios. Mick Ruiz is our special guest. And Mick, we talked in depth about how Bolt Doro came to be and how you were able to get him at the Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale, and then what you saw from him as he went to your ranch in Montana. You know, you think back to what we talked about in the first half of the show, and you wrestling in college, and in your senior year, you drop out, or wrestling in high school, you drop out of high school with 1 month to go. That had to be somewhat of a difficult decision to make. And then from there, you go right to Montana, you start your first business. Take me through some of that timeline and some of that progression.
Well, only reason I stayed in the school my senior year is because I wanted to wrestle. So the day after the tournament, state tournament, I said, that's it, because I was never a real good studier. I can't stay still and concentrate on one thing very long at all, maybe more than 5 minutes. So my decision is, you know what? You know how to work. You better go out and work, you know, because dad's not going to just give you money to hang out and be at the house. So that's what I did. I just, you know, went to work. Was a laborer and in the laborers union, and my dad was in the laborers union, and they were all sitting in the labor hall, and they called for a scaffold builder, and I'm like, I'll go to work. And my dad said, son, you don't want to do that. That's really, really hard work and it's dangerous. I said, okay, dad, you got 20 bucks for me then? I think you ought to take that job, he told me. So I took the job as a scaffold builder, and I was like, wow, this is super cool. You get to go up high. You know, it was challenging. You were building things every day, and worked really hard. And, you know, I moved my way up to the company, and then I was like the youngest carpenter they ever had. And then like in 2 years, I was running the whole shop for them, and I was only like 23 years old. And then my owner of the company, he ended up selling his company, and I would have stayed. I'd still be with him today. I wouldn't have had nothing if he would have never sold. I'm that, you know, loyal. And he sold it, and I said, well, I helped him build this company. Then he sold it for, you know, I think like only like $9 million or something. And I said, I can do this myself. And so that's what I did and started my first scaffold company and ended up started with $30,000 and ended up selling it for about $2.5 million. And so I said, okay, now I'm going to be what I love. I'm going to be a horse trainer. So I bought a ranch from Carl Maggio. He's been in the horse racing for a long time. He died of brain cancer here about 14, 15 years ago. But he owned a ranch also in Kentucky, you know, and he bred the mama to Cigar. So their family had been in it for a long time, the Maggios. So I bought the ranch since he was had brain cancer. So I bought half of it and put a couple houses on it. We had a little racetrack out in San Diego County. So the $2.5 million that I got from my company, you know, wasn't that much money if you're getting into horse racing. I'll tell you that. By the time I put the houses on it, cleaned it out, water, did everything, you know, I didn't have much money left. So I was buying, you know, I bought a mare and foal for $10,000. Folder had it. That was one of my first Wendy. I think that was that was Wendy's back. My first horse was Don't Tell Wendy. I bought it $10,000 at the Barrett sale. Rick Taylor from Specialty Thoroughbreds helped me buy it, and we go there, and I told him, hey, don't tell Wendy I'm going to buy this horse, and then we'll go show her afterwards. So we bought the horse for $10,000, took her back to the stall, and I said, hey, babe, look at the horse I bought. She goes, you bought that? I go, yeah, I told Rick not to tell you. So I named the horse Don't Tell Wendy. it's made a couple $100,000. So for $10,000, that was pretty good. You know, that's, you know, you're thinking you're, you know, this is a pretty easy game. Well, next year, whole year of training and having horses that really can't compete where we wanted to compete, you know, lost money. Next year we had a horse that we had, and I named it Wendy's On To Me. So that horse ended up winning a couple $100,000 too. And, you know, so I was really lucky with these Wendy names. But about 4 years into training, I was about $1 million in debt. I needed to get back to work, but I couldn't because I had a non-compete clause when I sold my company for $2.5 million. So we struggled. And the day I could go back to work, I did, you know, and I said, I'm not coming back into the business until I can compete to where, you know, I can run a horse against Bob, or I can run a horse against Mr. Drysdale or Mr. Mandela. You know, this is where, if you don't have the horsepower, you're never going to be able to compete against them. So we did that, and people asked me, you got any more horses? I said, no. They go, well, how you doing? I'm doing okay. You know, I'm starting my construction company back, and I'm back to work. And, you know, they, well, are you and Wendy still together? Oh, yeah, me and Wendy are still together. I said, if we're not together, it'll be the horse you hear me named saying, anybody seen Wendy? But, you know, she, when I didn't have no money to when we had a lot of money, you know, she's been the same person to me, and it's really, really cool training with her every day. And so then we moved back from Montana to California to really build up the company. I said we'd stay down here a couple of years. It got really big. We had a branch in San Diego, then opened a branch in Bremerton, Washington, opened a branch in Norfolk, Virginia, one in Honolulu, Hawaii, and then Mayport, Florida. So we were in five major branches for the Naval Shipyard. So we became the largest supplier of scaffolding for repair of Navy vessels. So I ended up selling 80% of it to ex-Secretary of the Navy, John Layman. So he's my partner. Got to meet a really cool person, you know, all the history. And he was, he was the youngest Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan. So he's my partner now. I own 20% still. I'm still the CEO. We're about 750 strong of that. So we still do that. That's really fun because that's a passion. And it's, you know, the company I started with five guys till I sold the majority of it when we had 600. So we do that, and I really love that still. But we're training every day, so I don't travel, you know. Just try to do my business by phone, go see the horses every day. But that's pretty much the story how I made it from not having nothing to having something to really not having something. When I started American Scaffold again, I was $1 million in debt. So first job I went back on was back in New York, and I was gone for 69 days from the family, getting the job done, trying to make some money to dig us out of debt. And, you know, kept working hard and, you know, got lucky, did what I would say I would do and earned that reputation in the shipyard amongst admirals and other people that were, you know, in the industry. And next thing I know, you know, we were the largest, and it was in a matter of 5 years, we were the largest scaffolding repair for the United States Navy. And I take that when people say, well, what do you feel like when you got to go against Mr. Lucas or Mr. Pletcher or Chad Brown or Bob Baffert? When I was started negative $1 million with my company, I had to bid against billion-dollar companies in the scaffold industry. And I had to hear them say every day, they're going to go broke. They cannot do it for that price. And one thing I learned, when you're in control of your little part, and you're not trying to spread yourself out too much, it's hard for the big guy with all the overhead to come and compete against you. And I'm kind of, that is my way I'm running my barn now, where we started it from the scratch. If they made it, they made it. We have the hardest working people there. They give me 110%. I probably pay more than anybody else pays on the backside, but that's well deserved. So that's kind of my operation starting now, and I do want to start an East Coast stable so we can train out of Keeneland there, kind of close there. So I'm thinking right now that, you know, one of my assistants is going to go out there, and they'll have about 10 of my horses next year.
Trainer Mick Ruiz, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mick, I love that story because, as I referenced at the top of the show, it really does speak to the perseverance, the determination that it took to get you back to where you are today. I also love the part of the story where you were able to sell 80% of American Scaffold. And at that point, though, you got a little bit of bad news from your accountant, but you had a pretty good answer for him.
Yeah, he said, you know, you're going to have a $17 million tax bill. And I said, wow. But I'm like, well, hey, it could be worse. You know, I could owe that and couldn't pay for it. But he says, you know what, let's make a plan of you. You like your horses, right? And I said, yes. He goes, you know, we'll budget out where you can spend about $2.5 million for the first couple of years and get that tax liability down. And I said, hey, that's good. So Wendy always laughs when I find a good deal. And I say, babe, it's like getting it for free. I told her this deal. The horses are like free. We're spending $2.5 million, but it's like free. And she's like, okay, it's one of your almost like getting it for free deals, huh? And I said, yeah, really. And we just, you know, we spent $1.4 million the first year, and we got Union Strike, and, you know, we got offered at one time $3 million for her, but we wanted to keep her as our broodmare and still run her. And the next year we spent about $1.6 million. And that's when we got Bolt Oro in that group, you know. So we spent all of our money. And then when Bolt came, it's like my accountant goes, you have another problem. And I said, well, what's that? I said, we spent $5 million. He goes, yeah, but you made money. Oh, he goes, oh, man. So I said, well, I guess that's a good thing. So then that's when we purchased Mr. House's Chestnut Farm in Lexington. And then we spent this year about $2.6 million on yearlings, you know, and I think it's my best crop that we've got to date, you know. And just so that, like I said, my money that's going to be made out of horse racing is going back into horse racing. I don't need to make my living for this. So it's going to be fun. It's a, you know, I knew what it was, the pressure were when you didn't have money. I used to, from my ranch in Descanso in San Diego County, I would go all the way to watch my son, Little Mick, when he was a jockey in Turf Paradise. I'd take my trailer and my one ton so I could buy the grain and the hay and everything else cheaper there, and then take it all the way 2.5-3 hours back home up the grade, you know, to San Diego County's, because, boy, I needed to save that $800 because that's what it was going to keep the ranch going and the training going, you know. So I know how hard it is for some of these guys on the backside that they work so hard and, you know, just to barely make it. I mean, they're literally working for their own wages. So to be in the position that we're in, to be able to buy the horses, to get some better help, not to worry about that, hey, I'm going to have to do this because if I drop this horse or if I get this to get the win, that's what we're going to need to survive. You know, that's when you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself and you're not really making the right moves when you have to make the moves.
Well, and now you get to go down this road, Mick, with your family and your wife, Wendy, by your side. You work very closely together in your business now, Ruiz Racing. How did you and Wendy end up meeting?
That's another, Mick doesn't stay still too much. We met each other. I was a single dad with three children. And then, you know, back 24 years ago, that wasn't really heard of, you know. But I was a single dad. I had three children. I had a 12-year-old daughter. Little Mick was 7, and Corey, my son, was 1.5. And I moved to Montana because I was a workaholic. And I said, how am I going to raise these kids? Well, if I go to Montana, it'll slow me down a little bit, and I can still do it. And I met Wendy through someone at church, where we're going to church. And she was widowed with a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. And 3 weeks later, we got married.
Wow. That's cool. You just knew right away, huh?
Well, you know, I knew that I was, before I was married, like 13, and I thought I knew and got a big surprise. So I said, hey, we're going to make this work along the way. And, you know, it's been wonderful. And then we've had two children together. So 3 weeks from the day we met, we had 5 instant, and then we had 2 together. So we raised 7 children.
Wow.
Yeah. Wendy described you as being really charming. And then she said, how do you date when you have 5 children? So we just decided to get married.
Yeah. And she's, her nationality, she's 100% Japanese. So they really methodical, right? They think things out. They're not like me. So, boy, you could imagine what her family thought.
Tell me about your unique fork-holding habits, Mick.
Yeah, well, you know, I never learned to really eat proper, you know, kind of renegade growing up, you know. And so I would, like, hold my fork like a shovel. And so I was getting ready to go out with Wendy and my friend who I bought a house from, Montana, goes, you're not going to hold your fork like that on your date, are you? And I go, like what? And he goes, it looks like you got a shovel in your hand. So I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? So I thought it out. I said, I invited her for our first date to a sandwich shop so I didn't have to use utensils.
Very clever.
Brilliant.
That's great.
Talking with Mick Ruiz here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on HRRN. Fun visit. If you miss any portion of the show, head on over to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast at your leisure. You can do that, Horse Racing Radio Network, on iTunes as well, and follow us at HRRN on Twitter. Mick, what did that experience of overcoming all of the adversity and getting back to where you are today, what did that experience teach you as you were going through those hard times?
A lot of discipline of how you got to do business. You know, I had a couple of real tough decisions when, you know, we had a regular exercise rider on Bolt. You know, and say you were an exercise rider on Bolt, is that one of the most glamorous things you can do, right? Say, wow, I'm a Bolt Earl. And then I changed the exercise rider because I just wanted to, I didn't think they really fit him as good as this other one would. But you know how hard of a decision that was. But through my business and my heartaches, not having money, building companies, I said, you know, I still love this kid. He's still a great rider. But for the whole team, I make those tough decisions, super tough decisions. And it worked out. We taught him how to jog better, work on his back end, get him stronger, you know. So that I would say, helped me out a lot in my training, where sometimes you're not going to be the most popular person, but you have to know that you're got to do the best that you think is for the entire team, even if you're the unpopular guy.
Yeah, we saw that at the Kentucky Derby last year with Always Dreaming, and he was being a handful, and the gal that was galloping him had galloped him quite a bit, but you could see that Todd was wondering, you know, what should I do here? And eventually they changed riders, and it made a big difference to the horse. It was so noticeable when you were watching him train, and it's those subtle little differences that can, you know, be the key to winning or losing sometimes. But it is hard when you have to make those decisions, especially, you know, if it's somebody that you're fond of or that you you know, have a lot of respect for. But it has to be done, and you've overcome so much. That's got to give you a lot of confidence to you know, go to the barn every morning, because you know, no matter what the adversity is, and Richard Mandela says every morning when you go to the barn, there's something wrong. I don't know if that's totally true, but it's true a lot of the time. Does that give you confidence when you go in that no matter what, it's going to be okay?
Yes. I mean, I hear people say, you know, wow, is it tough training? Is it tough doing this? And I'd say, you know what's really tough? Raise 7 children, a blended family. You know, have 800 employees, still have 800 employees in about 5 companies. You know, this is relaxing, coming here every morning with my wife and do this. And, yeah, things do happen. You're like going, oh, my gosh, getting a tendon on that one. Kick her out. Kick her out. That we'll bring her back in 6 months. You know, we don't have to keep going on her and, you know, count our losses, do the right thing. So I think they can handle it from everything else that we did in life, but things do happen every day that's very disappointing. But, you know, in the bigger picture, there's a lot more adversity that I've gone through than, you know, a horse getting hurt or a horse having some time off or, you know, we look at it, I look at it, I go, man, would it be the end of the world if Bolt doesn't go any farther or something happens to him? No. Would it be disappointing? Oh, hell yeah. I mean, I don't know what, you know, we think we can get there. We think we got the right horse. But you know what? We got 20 yearlings coming in. We got 22-year-olds that are here already. So you're always still hoping for another one. And that, I think, is a luxury that we have now that takes some of the pressure off, that he isn't just the one horse that we have. He is the one special horse. He's the one everyone's talking about. But at the end of the day, if Bolt's not there, we're still there and we're still enjoying it.
Mick, even after you sold your second company and were able to make it back to owning and training and running your operation as you're doing it now, there was still some controversy and adversity that you had to overcome with your training license and trying to get licensed again to do what you're doing now.
You know, I'm a super stubborn person. And when I was coming back, when I brought the first batch, I told my daughter Shelby, I said, look, they said that I have to go take my test again. And I told Stuart, I'm not taking my test. Why should I have to take my test? I already had it. I've had winters. I didn't not forget what I was supposed to do. You know, I trained for 5 years, did very good. You know, I had one the year that we was at San Luis Rey. I was one of the top winners out of San Luis Rey. And no, you've been gone for 10 years. You need to do it. And I'm stubborn. I went, no. So I said, Shell, I'm going to buy some horses. You take out your trainer's license and we'll train them. So we did that. And, you know, it's really hard when you're working with your children because they're your children. You know, if you're the boss and they're not your children, they're going to listen to you. And it was a rocky start like that with Shelby and, you know, with the horse we had. And the best thing that ever happened is people would always say he fired his daughter. She quit. She fired her dad. Said, Dad, I can't handle it. You know, you do it. And so, you know, I said, okay, you know, I'll do it because that's what I wanted to do in the beginning. Well, then I asked, you know, I had another trainer because I said I wasn't going to take my test. But from the day one, I was there training every day. And then finally the stewards came up to me after the third trainer and said, Mick, we know you're training every day. We see this. It's like you're depriving the public. You need to go get your license. So I said, okay, I'll go get it. So talked to Shelby, and she had just taken her a year ahead of time. I go, Shelby, why don't you, school me on this for a day? So I got to go take my test tomorrow. And she goes, okay. So she came over for about 4 hours. She helped me study how I was going to do it. And I went in there, and here's a guy, remember, dropout guy from school, that can't study for 5 minutes long. And I went in, and I got 97%. And he goes, there's only one other person that scored as high as you last year. I go, who's that? And he goes, your daughter. I go, well, then I had a good teacher, right?
Oh, great story.
So I just got my own license.
Yeah, great story. And it's worked out pretty well for trainer Mick Ruiz, who is here with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton. Mick, only 2 minutes left in the show, believe it or not. It's been a tremendously enjoyable visit. Real quick, when Mick Ruiz is not at the racetrack, and I know that's rare, what are some of the other things that you enjoy doing?
Well, I'm getting ready to go play racquetball. I love racquetball. And I just love going back to Montana. We're building a lot of condos and stuff back there. There's a little town called Columbia Falls that we're really involved in. We bought a lumber mill back there and stuff like that. I'm really into helping people and building jobs, because when I was 18 years old, I remember wanting to work so hard, but it was a construction recession then, and there was no work, even though I wanted to. So I really try to create jobs for the people that really want to work. That's my passion.
All right, Mick, in just a couple of words, if you could win the Kentucky Derby, it would be what?
It would be for all the boots and hammer guys, the blue-collar guys, the guys that tried hard, that could say, you might have had a hiccup along the road one time, but, just grab your bootstraps and keep going. And if we were to win the Kentucky Derby, I already made a pact with Wendy. She said she's going to look really, really nice. And I said, okay, baby, you always look nice, but I'm going to be the guy I might put a sport coat on, but I will have a white working T-shirt underneath that in the winner's circle.
Well said. He's Mick Ruiz here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton. Mick, what a visit. Can't thank you enough for spending a little time. All the best with Bolt Doro and all your horses, and keep it rolling.
Okay, thank you guys, huh?
All right, Mick Ruiz. Don't forget, if you missed any portion, head to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast. The guy's a freak.
Yeah, he's hardest working guy in the world.
Yeah,
I mean, all the things that he has to juggle, but does a great job at all of them. Fantastic story.
Talk about it a lot. People that are at that level and have that kind of success, they work their tails off. And Mick Ruiz, maybe even more than most. Well done, Mick. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton, and it's right here on HRN.